This weekend starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
No rest for the weary. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
As parts of the eastern seaboard hunker down due to Hurricane Florence, many regions in the storm's path are still recovering from previous storms.
The school day typically ends 2 hours before the average workday. Is it time to change that? We'll examine the logistics.
Why a character from the Lord of the Rings books would write to the FCC about football.
And the workers who thrive on negative feedback.
There have been several recent studies that actually shed light on the thinking of people who really crave a harsh critique. There are people who are strivers. They believe they can improve their skills and abilities. They have what you call a growth mindset. Their personal goals are so clear to them that they see feedback as a tool for reaching them rather than as a setback.
Wall Street Journal columnist Sue Schellenberger on employees who crave a harsh critique. She's here in about 20 minutes. Well, across eastern North Carolina, people prepared for Hurricane Florence as it churned directly at the low-lying region. Many evacuated, driving west to higher ground. Others boarded up windows, moved precious items to higher floors, stockpiled food and water. The storm is expected to be more severe than Hurricane Matthew, a storm that struck eastern and central North Carolina 2 years ago, killing at least 25 people and damaging about 100,000 homes. More from Wall Street Journal reporter Karen McWhirter. Cam, what have you found?
So in 2016, in October, Hurricane Matthew came, and not sure you remember that, but everyone was terrified it was going to pummel Florida. It ended up sort of skirting the coast to the great relief of the state, but then hit as a Category 1 storm. It hit the North Carolina coast and then parked over North Carolina, over eastern North Carolina, for a long period of time, dumping tons of rain, which is, as these increasingly more powerful storms, that's what they do. They'll just dump some way more rain than we're used to.
Yeah.
So eastern North Carolina was terribly flooded. I mean, it caused almost $5 billion in damage. So there's been that's obviously devastated that portion of the state. A lot of it's rebuilt, but they're trying to, there's still lots of federal funding that hasn't come in yet to make those repairs in a lot of the communities away from the coast. And now here comes this other storm, which is a Category 4 hurricane, and which is being, at this point, forecasted to produce a lot more rain than Matthew did.
Boy, federal money is only coming in now, 2 years later?
People in North Carolina have made similar comments, thrown in some expletives with that statement. Yes. Yeah. No, I mean, there's a procedure. The state has produced a lot of money, but the federal government money took more time to go through the channels, and some of it now is just being distributed. And there's a lot of finger pointing about that. But it's not going to be of any use for this storm because here it comes.
Boy. All right. You open your piece with a story about this place, Jernigan Furniture, in Goldsboro, North Carolina. What was their experience like, and what are they doing this time?
Yeah, they were devastated by Matthew, and this time they're not taking any chances, and they're just pulling out. They're moving all their inventory and product out by truck. And I talked to other businesses as well, and I talked to a guy who runs a Piggly Wiggly. He has two Piggly Wiggly stores in North Carolina. And one of them was flooded in Matthew. So this time he's got a generator for his other one, and he's ready to move product out if he has to. But everybody is hunkering down and a lot of people are just moving, are just driving away. They're boarding up their homes, locking up their homes, and just driving away to the center part of the state or beyond, because that's going to get a lot of rain too. Raleigh and the Raleigh area is going to get hit by a lot of rain, and they expect a lot of power outages.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Cameron McWhirter. He's written a piece entitled Facing Florence. Some North Carolinians are still recovering from previous storms, most specifically Hurricane Matthew back in 2016. How about this? These residents of Belhaven, this tiny tiny town. They had a lot of homes elevated, you said, after Floyd in 99. Are they clear? Like of I guess flooding?
They don't. That's, well, in theory, that's why you elevate the homes, but we don't know what's going to happen. I was talking to an expert who was saying, you know, we, as these storms intensify and are, have been intensifying in recent years, you know, all of our predictions regarding, you know, 100-year flood, 200-year flood, 300-year flood are being revised. And so we don't know if we're preparing. We're preparing for uncertainty. We don't know how bad the storms are going to be. So this will be, we'll have to see how badly Belhaven, for example, is hit, but we just don't know. This is going to be a great test to see if those elevated homes actually, if that actually does anything. There are other places, you know, about after Floyd, the state, through with federal money, purchased about 5,000 homes in flood-prone areas and just destroyed them and turned them back into open land.
Thanks, Cam. It's Wall Street Journal reporter Cameron McWhirter. 12 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Across the country, parents are struggling to balance their busy work routine with their children's school schedule. Both parents work in half of married couples, or married couple families, rather, and 70% of them work from 8 till 5, a reality that leaves most families to contend with at least a two-hour gap between when the school ends and when the workday ends. While mothers were once expected to be full-time caregivers, 75% of women with school-aged children now work, yet fewer than half of American public schools offer an after-school program. Can the two interests ever align? Kara Vogt, writer for The Atlantic, has been exploring. Kara, set this up.
This piece actually came to me. I was back in Connecticut over the Easter holiday, and I saw on a local news that there are all these parents who are waiting in line overnight to sign their kids up for an after-school program. And when I started to just dig into the what was going on there, I learned that this is actually a pretty universal issue. A lot of parents are facing this same kind of gap, and they're trying to rely on whether the school system or private childcare or something to take care of their kids when they're still working. So I pieced together here, you know, I took a look at where this is happening. I reached out to some experts and looked at some other examples of, are there any schools or programs that are doing this differently? And unfortunately, didn't really come up with a one-size-fits-all solution, but definitely found some interesting ideas as to what people are thinking about when it comes to solving this issue.
Okay, so some might argue that the school day needs to line up more with a traditional 9-to-5, 8-to-4 type of workday, I guess, but it's not as easy as just snapping your fingers, obviously. What are some of the issues that you came across?
Well, certainly, first of all, there's just the way the school schedule's been built. You know, inertia is very, very powerful in these circumstances. So teachers' contracts are negotiated usually through a union. They are set for a period of time. There's all kinds of other activities that come with school. So we're looking at, you know, maybe it's soccer or sports generally that require the use of a field, and maybe that field doesn't have lights, and so that necessitates the sport to happen in the early afternoon, so school has to end before sports can occur. There's also, you know, we think a lot about the professional workday as you describe, from 8 to 4, 9 to 5, but, you know, for a shift schedule, this actually kind of works out for some families. So, you know, one size fits all here isn't really something that schools can approach, but certainly impediments like the way the day is structured, making sure there's enough time for professional development, enough time for vacations, enough time to compensate teachers who are still working after school to grade papers, for example, all that kind of, you know, factors into why the school day has remained the way it is.
You pointed out too, I think, right, we could go from a 6.5 hour school day to an 8 hour school day if things were to match up. Now you're talking about adding what amounts to an extra work day per week for a teacher, right, in terms of hours.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. That would bridge the gap on what we call a traditional standard professional work day, 9 to 5.
So have we done this before ever? Have anybody ever tried it?
There actually have been some pilot programs, some of which actually have been funded through the Department of education. Some schools extended their work day. Some schools extended their school day, you know, by an hour or two. And the schools that did this, they tried a couple different models from what I remember. Some had some more one-on-one time with students. Some partnered up with community organizations to try to create some more alternative learning experiences for students. And on the whole, schools that engage in a longer school day have found that students have increased academic performance. The idea here, of course, and people always emphasize this to me when I ask them about it, it's not that there should be more classroom time. And it's really not about childcare. It's about finding ways to keep students interested and engaged and a little more individual attention to really help them succeed in school.
We're speaking with Kara Vogt, writer for The Atlantic. She's written a piece entitled, Why Does the School Day End 2 Hours Before the Work Day? At least in many situations. What kind of feedback have you gotten on this story?
Seems to have hit a nerve with people, I would say. This piece has been shared around quite a bit, and a lot of people I've heard from have said, absolutely, this is my story. You know, I don't have crazy lines after school, as we saw in South Windsor, but they are saying that they're having a really hard time bridging the gap, trying to find a nanny or a friend or someone who can take care of their child. Some people are saying, you know, especially people who are teachers or work in education, they point out the real barriers to this and all of the sort of intricacies that get in the way of making this a reality. Some people, you know, very rightly so, I didn't have as much space as I necessarily would have wanted to get into every facet of the issue. But certainly there are families for which, you know, the low income, or maybe their families work unique shift schedule or work in the service industry, and you know, they're trying to find childcare overnight for their kids. So lots of different responses. Clearly, it seems to me like Americans generally are trying to find ways to take care of their kids at all different kinds of times of day. And the idea that parents would be really struggling in one town, as I reported in the story, it seems like it could have been any town in America based on the response I got.
Thanks, Kara. Kara Vogt, writer for The Atlantic. It sounds like it might be easier to make the work day or the average day 26 hours, right? Just need those 2 extra hours that would get it done. 22 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The best place to start or grow your business is at michiganbusiness.org. Contact them today. Many people hate getting negative feedback and avoid dishing it out, too, fearing it will spark anger, dejection, or even tears. But some people actually want and even seek out criticism at work. Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
Most of us don't like negative feedback, but believe it or not, there are some who do. Sue Schellenbarger of the Wall Street Journal joins us now with some details. Sue, who are these people?
There have been several recent studies that actually shed light on the thinking of people who really crave a harsh critique. They're people who are strivers. They believe they can improve their skills and abilities. They have what you call a growth mindset. Their personal goals are so clear to them that they see feedback as a tool for reaching them rather than as a setback. And they also tend to have close friends at work. They invest in these relationships and they seek out real honest critiques from these people.
If they have close friends at work, do they also have to really like the job they're in?
Not necessarily. I think some people see a job as a stepping stone to something further off in the future. I think what's more important is that they really invest in every position they have. They don't rest on their oars. They try very hard to grow, regardless of whether they like their assignment or not.
Do these people ask for feedback from their bosses, coworkers, or both?
Both, actually, and clients as well. Some of the really rigorous self-improvers that I interviewed said they are constantly asking after meetings with clients, friends, coworkers, bosses, you know, anything I could have done better there or anything you would have done differently. And they're constantly taking in this input so that they can see themselves as others see them.
So is there a difference between receiving negative feedback and receiving criticism?
It's pretty much the same, although I think anybody who takes the trouble to call it negative feedback has probably thought through the ramifications for the listener. I think people who are careful about feedback at work. Think of it as feedback, and they try to couch it in a respectful way. They don't mount a broadside. They don't make it a personal attack, but instead they just focus on the behavior that should be changed. And also, they send a message that, you know, I have faith in you. I know you can change this if you try.
We're speaking with Sue Schellenbarger of the Wall Street Journal. Should you ever give negative feedback to someone if it's unsolicited?
One of the interesting pieces of research recently showed that people who are expert or experienced or quite skilled in their work really look for negative feedback. But if you're working with a novice, it's wise to be more cautious. What the researchers found is that a novice really needs encouragement and thrives more on positive feedback. And the reason is they're not even sure yet whether they've made the right investment, got the right job, whether they can do this or not. And they take feedback as a way of increasing their commitment. So all of these studies you see coming out saying that millennial workers like positive feedback and praise, probably true, because many of them are new in their jobs.
Sue, what if you get this negative feedback and you think it is not warranted?
I think always take it with a grain of salt. Tasha Yurick, an author on this topic on self-awareness, said, take time to reflect on it. If it doesn't ring true to you, just first of all, take time to get over the emotion, whether it's anger or embarrassment or shame or whatever you're feeling. Think about it, decide whether you believe it, and if you do believe it, whether it's worth trying to change. Consult a mentor, a friend, a trusted colleague, and see what they think. You don't always have to react to feedback or take it at face value.
Thanks, Sue. That's Wall Street Journal columnist Sue Schellenbarger with this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. When a state ranks among the top 10 in the country for major new and expanded facilities, that's pure growth. When it's tops for four straight years, that's pure Michigan. Long known as a world leader in the automotive industry, Michigan is also a leader in advanced manufacturing, cybersecurity, agribusiness, and aerospace. In fact, CNBC rates Michigan as the most improved state for business. To learn more, visit michiganbusiness.org. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Coming up this half hour, recounting memorable financial advice. Also, the social media network most likely to incriminate you, and fake fans lobbying in favor of the NFL blackout. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. Whether you're in Florence's direct path or not, the impending danger can cause stress and anxiety to build up. How can you manage it? Learn to trigger what's called autonomous sensory meridian response, or ASMR. Guidance from Dr. Craig Richard, professor of biomedical sciences at Shenandoah University in Virginia. Dr. Richard, what can we do?
If they have internet access, there's ASMR videos. And these are thousands of videos that are widely popular. And people have been using these for years to de-stress, to calm down, to feel soothed. And even if people are having trouble sleeping in this moment, that can also help. And ASMR can also be done person to person. So chances are you're going to be with someone who cares a lot about you. And that's really the ideal situation for stimulating ASMR and in any kind of stressful situation. And those are the people that can best stimulate this super relaxing feeling in you. And so this is whether it's your family members or a close friend or just anyone that you feel comfortable with. Mm. And just through their behaviors and their voice, and their light touch,
even
help get you into that deeply relaxing feeling.
So in the face of, say, Hurricane Florence, which is bringing these howling winds, devastating floods they're talking about because of the heavy rains, folks are fearful of losing everything, perhaps. How do you remain calm in this situation, assuming you're not hunkered down in a home that's about to be demolished? But what's a reasonable, I don't know, exercise to do?
Yeah, I think the first thing, make sure you're safe. Make sure you're in a safe location. You've done everything to make the environment you're in physically safe. Being with others is probably the next most important step. So that way, anything that you can deal with as a group, which for logistics is very helpful, and psychologically that's very helpful. And then once you have all that situation there, then you're in a safe place with safe people. That can be a great situation to further stimulate ASMR. Because now they can kind of focus on you directly. And that's what stimulates ASMR, is personal moments of caring attention. Hmm. And so if you're feeling stressed, you can have someone very gently talk to you. And the strange thing is, whispering is very good at stimulating this deep feeling of relaxation. So encourage the other person to whisper to you and even lightly touch you. And this is with your permission, which is very important.
Yeah, yeah.
But maybe lightly run their finger on your forearm, or lightly trace letters on your back, or lightly play with your hair. All of those things can help get you into that great feeling of relaxation in these stressful times.
Is everyone capable of feeling that?
It doesn't seem so. There are plenty of people that have tried lots of these ASMR videos. They've reflected on moments in their life, and they say they've never experienced this deep feeling of relaxation and these brain tingles in moments that I've described. So it doesn't appear that everyone can. It seems about 20% definitely can and strongly can. And maybe a little more than that experience a more mild version, where maybe they feel deeply relaxed, but they may not feel those signature brain tingles.
What do you think is misunderstood about stressful situations? Like maybe that this type of help is available and we don't dial it up?
Yeah, I think what's just misunderstood is just the lack of awareness, might be the better term I would think of, is that when people think of relaxation techniques, they think of very helpful things like yoga and meditation and other forms of relaxation techniques and de-stressing. But right now, ASMR isn't on most people's radar. But if you're someone who maybe yoga and meditation and other common things don't work for you, this ASMR may be the new thing as strongly works for you.
That is Dr. Craig Richard, professor of biomedical sciences at Shenandoah University in Winchester, Virginia. 21 minutes in front of the hour now on This Weekend. Hey, glad you're with us. Think about some of the memorable financial advice you've heard or received, whether it's good or bad. We can gather financial facts and research issues, but what we learn will always be tainted by what we've experienced. More from Jonathan Clements, former Wall Street Journal financial writer, now editor of HumbleDollar.com. Jonathan, explain.
So what happens, Gordon, is we all learn about money from reading books, reading articles, listening to experts. When we get that information, we're always going to look at it through the lens of what we personally have experienced. And those personal experiences, the things we've heard, the things we observed, are so much more powerful than what we hear from the experts. I mean, it's almost overwhelmed. We all know that anecdotes tend to trump, detailed analysis. Or there's the famous phrase, one death is a tragedy, 20,000 deaths is a statistic. That's the nature of it. And when I think about it, I particularly think about people like, who grew up in the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. I mean, that the day-to-day suffering that they had trying to make do through the 1930s influenced that generation for the rest of their lives. They were far more frugal than we are today simply because they had those experiences.
To your point, some of the takeaways I had from reading this was that some advice was good, but maybe was just limited to a specific point in time. Right? Or as you mentioned, given by someone of a certain age and experience.
Yeah, so I mentioned in the piece that one of the things that my mother used to say during the 1970s was that you can't go wrong with real estate. And in the 1970s, it certainly seemed like you couldn't go wrong with real estate. And when I heard that, I thought it was some, great secret I was learning. In the 1970s, real estate was indeed a great buy because you benefit from two reasons. One, inflation was going up, and housing prices tend to track inflation pretty closely. So if you owned a home, you got pretty good house price appreciation and protection against inflation. But at the same time, that inflation made the real cost of servicing your mortgage go down. You were getting salary increases simply because of inflation, but your mortgage payments were staying the same, so it became easier and easier to make those mortgage payments. Of course, all that changed in the 80s and the 90s. Home prices didn't do nearly as well. Inflation wasn't nearly as high. And meanwhile, a lot of people had very high-cost mortgages because they ended up taking out mortgages in the early 80s when interest rates were in double-digit levels.
The stock market crash in October of 1987. Explain your takeaways from that.
Yeah, well, I remember two things in particular from that. At the time, I was working at Forbes magazine as a lowly fact checker. And in those days, while people had sort of basic computer terminals, at the Forbes building, there was only one way you could find out what was going on with the stock market, and that was a paper ticker that was from Dow Jones. And people gathered around that ticker during the day and watched the prices come through. And during that day, as I recall it, we only got three readings on the Dow Jones Industrial Average because finding out what stocks were being priced at was so difficult.
Wow.
So the market was down 100 points in the morning, down about 230 in the afternoon, and then after the market closed, the final number came through, 508 points down, which was more than a 20% decline. And beyond the sort of the palpable sense of panic, it was also interesting as a young reporter to see how the other journalists reacted. And you probably know this, Gordon, from hanging around journalists. If anything, the journalists were almost giddy with excitement over the amount of financial suffering that was going on. There's nothing like journalists, dancing at people's funerals.
Thanks, Jonathan. Jonathan Clements, editor of HumbleDollar.com. It is 13 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Hey, glad you could spend part of your weekend with us. There's a lot to dislike on Facebook. Most employers now check social media to vet job applicants, right? And Facebook is the social network that hiring managers scrutinize more than any other. According to a survey of more than 600 hiring managers from HR solutions firm Paychex, Indeed, 85% say they check Facebook, 66% look on LinkedIn, and 40% eye Twitter and Instagram when vetting candidates. And it's Facebook where hiring managers most often find problems. We're joined now by Katie Hill, editor at Moneyish.com. Katie, what are we learning?
So 2 in 3 employers were saying that Facebook contains the most incriminating information about applicants on it. That's way, way, way ahead of Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn.
Wow. What if you have a private account?
Well, a lot of times they can get around that, too. So sometimes people will have a private account, and someone could, this woman was telling me that, they can create a fake account, ask to be your friend. You don't realize it doesn't come from Corporation X that wants to be your friend on Facebook. Mm. It's just another little thing they get in. They can see that. So even that isn't like a perfect way for you to cover up what's going on your Facebook.
Wow. All right. So what are the problems that some of these folks are finding when they look at your Facebook profile?
So the biggest ones are the obvious ones. Don't have a bunch of pictures of you drinking or doing drugs. Don't put discriminatory comments. But here are some of the things that surprised me that I think people don't realize could negatively impact them. Number one, looking at how often you post. So about 1 in 10 employers who have rejected a candidate because of social media said they did it because the candidate posted too frequently. Now, I think you're not looking at your Facebook thinking, oh, I'm posting too frequently. That's going to cost me the job. But it might. Because what it shows, right, is let's say you're posting during work multiple times, on a Monday they're seeing 3 or 4 posts. They're thinking, oh, this person isn't very dedicated to their current job. What's going to make them dedicated to this job? So that's something to think about. Try not to, look at your Facebook and see if it shows. If there's more than one post during the middle of what should be your work day, you might want to clean that up a little bit.
What was the point about assessing your online relationships?
Right, another thing, right? So the one guy who told me he had rejected the candidate because he saw them fighting with an ex online. They were just a little back and forth arguing, but he just thought, I don't need that drama in my workplace. And I heard a few other people kind of echo that. They want somebody who's going to, be chill, not going to communicate well with others, work well with others. And when you're fighting in such a public arena, they worry that you're going to bring that kind of drama into the workplace.
Wow. We're speaking with Katie Hill, editor at Moneyish.com. We're talking about the types of things that can trip you up on social media. You said, too, review which groups you like or are a member of.
Yeah, something you might not think of, but of course they can often see what groups you've liked. And you might have a million years ago, your friend said, oh, can you like my whatever group? Well, if that's something slightly controversial, something that might be polarizing, just go through that and make sure you don't have anything that just could, set off a red flag to them, really. But you've probably, sometimes you don't even know all the groups you liked because you just went through and liked it. You did it as a favor for somebody. Just clean that up before you start applying for jobs.
Thanks, Katie. Katie Hill, editor at Moneyish.com. It is 6 minutes now in front of the hour. On this weekend, we'll finish with this. An investigation by the Wall Street Journal has found what may be thousands of bogus, identically worded letters generated on behalf of the NFL, which were posted in 2014 to the FCC's website from scores of alleged fans. These supposed fans opposed an FCC move to repeal the blackout rule. That rule banned cable and satellite providers from showing home games that weren't sold out when the NFL blocked local TV broadcasts of those games. The decades-old blackout rule aimed to get people to buy tickets to go to the games. Several groups lobbied the FCC to dump the rule. One letter began, "I write to strongly urge you to maintain the FCC's current broadcast rules." It was signed Bilbo Baggins of Brooklyn. That name sounds familiar. Yeah, he's a hobbit from Middle-earth in the Lord of the Rings books. Two other letters continued, "The current system works," and were signed by a Luke Skywalker of Inglewood, Colorado, and Vladimir Stolichnaya, also of Brooklyn. The FCC dumped the blackout rule by a 5-0 vote. The NFL dropped its own blackout policy a year later. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.